Absolute Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers. It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN. Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Good morning. This is Rahel.
And Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel. Boker tov lekol ha'mazinim.
Tzoraim tovim b'Yisrael.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. We're on the internet on WSMNradio.com. And we'd like to remind you that your sponsorship in the form of donations or paid advertisements helps us to spread the good news about Israel to over 100,000 listeners. So to find out how to support Israel in this way, contact us at www.israelisraelnh.com. That's israelisraelnh.com. And we're going to start our show today, Sonia, by, first of all, we're going to remember Mary Jean Gardner, who was killed just a day or two ago in the explosion at the bus stop in Jerusalem. And she was, you want to tell us about her a little bit?
Yes, she was a British citizen. She came in Israel to be more profound in Hebrew in order for her to translate the Bible in a certain language in Africa. And
Mary,
she was killed.
Yes. Mary Jean Gardner was 59. I want to also say the names of people who are still struggling. They were hospitalized right now from the incident. Ad Shapira, who was 18, is 18. Daniel Yehuda ben Rachel Nurit is 13. David Amoyel is the owner of the snack stand next to the bus stop. This is not the first time it's happened to him. Elchanan Ovadia ben Alona is 14. Lea Bracha bat Shoshana Batya is 19. Natan Daniel ben Shulamit, 17. Netanel ben Shlomit is 18. Odelia Nachama bat Michal, she's in intensive care with head injuries. Sason ben Shulamit, also the second time that Sason has been injured in a terrorist attack in Jerusalem. And his wife is pregnant with their fifth child, suffering from panic and fear. Her name is Nechama bat Shoshana Shama. Shiloh ben Ofra is 15. And Shindel bat Rezel, also another seminary high school student. And I guess these are the victims, again, of terrorism that you will not hear about in the main news media outlets. You won't hear their names, and we like to remember who they are and say their names because these are people. We are people, and we don't want to be killed. And lots of people want to see us dead, and I don't see the point of that. And speaking of our show, what we do here, we try and bring the good news. We try and look beyond all of this, but sometimes it's not that easy. So we go right now to our Hebrew word.
Miut. It's hard to change the tone, but miut. Miut is from the adjective me'at, which means a small quantity. However, miut means minority. And let's see why we choose this word.
All right.
though my soul's weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened be, that I am still and wake here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me.
Our guest today, Dexter Van Zyl, is a Christian media analyst for CAMRA, the Committee for Accuracy in the Middle East Reporting in America. His writings have appeared in numerous American Jewish newspapers, as well as the Jerusalem Post, Ecumenical Trends, and the Boston Globe. He has a BA in politics and government from the University of Puget Sound, and an MA in political science and environmental studies from Western Washington University. Dexter Van Zyl is devoted to promoting accurate and balanced coverage of Israel and the Middle East through researching and monitoring the media. And we're happy to have Dexter here on our show for a second time. Dexter, Boker Tov, Shalom.
Thank you for having me. Hi, Rahel. How are you?
Very good. I mean, you know, in light of the news, we're saddened about the situation, and I think that, you know, you're gonna bring us some more information about these kinds of events, unfortunately.
How are you? I'm a little concerned about it, you know, this attack, because, you know, I've been calling around to some of my friends that are more knowledgeable than me, and one of the things that they've said is that this attack looks like it was it was set off remotely. You know, it was like a remote control pipe bomb. That's what it's looking like. I don't know if you've heard anything else, Rahel or Sonia, but that's what I've heard. And what that means is that, you know, that it takes a fair amount of sophistication and training to actually be able to do one, you know, an attack like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, a lot easier to pull these types of attacks off than it is to recruit a suicide bomber, frankly. And so, you know, the real question at this point that I'm worried about is whether or not we're seeing the beginnings of a third intifada.
Well, we know that the situation is escalating. I mean, you know, we had last week a terrorist infiltration into killed the Fogel, five members of the Fogel family. And before that, we saw, you know, some stabbings again escalating. These things start out like that, and then it goes into full-fledged intifada again. And we know that various elements are calling for that.
Yeah, there's even a website on Facebook that's basically calling for a third intifada.
Right, and we're asking that be taken down. Let's see what they do on Facebook.
Nothing. Yeah,
when will they be taken in for, you know, as accomplices to incitement and murder in the end?
Yeah, and the thing is that I think people are trying to portray this, you know, if this turns out to be an intifada, they'll try and portray it as the equivalent of, like, the uprising in Egypt or Yemen or Tunisia. And I just want to say, look, you know, those uprisings were of people trying to basically affect their own leaders. But this is an attack on a sovereign state by another group of people, some of whom have declared they don't accept its right to exist.
Right.
And, you know, this is, I want to acknowledge that, yeah, not all the Palestinians feel that way, but a sufficient number of them do, so that this war can continue. And until that changes, you know, we're going to see intense suffering on both sides of this conflict, and Israel will do what it has to do in order to protect its sovereignty.
Yeah, we'll continue to do that, and I hope one day that people will see the justice in what Israel does. And the reasons why. I mean, you know, Israel does not just turn around and attack innocent people.
Right. And I think that, you know, I think that the bigger issue that people are, you know, I think one of the things is I think the Holocaust is no longer going to be the central mainstay of demonstrating Israel's legitimacy going forward. I think a lot of people, and I don't mean to offend people, but I think, and I'm shocked by what I'm going to tell you, but I think it's true, is I think that there are a lot of people that just think that the Holocaust was ancient history and that it really doesn't have anything to say about, you know, what's going on in Israel anymore. And that's a reality that I think we have to contend with. And, you know, despite the fact that that there are leaders in the Middle East that are intent on finishing the job that Hitler started. That's quite clear. But for some reason, just people don't want to hear that story.
Right. Well, in the context of things, it is a continuation of Hitler's right. program.
Right. And but the thing is that, and so at this point, you know, one of the other arguments that I think we're going to have to make, and I think it's a very powerful argument, is that, look, Israel is the, you know, is a beacon for religious and ethnic minorities in the Middle East.
You know, exactly.
Yeah.
Israel, you know, Israeli Jews have been able to do what other dhimmi populations or in Muslim-majority countries have been unable to do, and that is basically gain independence and achieve their own safety, you know, by, you know, fighting on their behalf. And I think that if you, and I think that in many respects, Israel is a beacon for all of those indigenous populations. And, you know, when you're talking about the Copts in Egypt and the Iraqi Christians in Iraq and the Maronite Christians that have been, you know, subject to, you know, ongoing depredations at a certain point, you know, and then, you know, when you look at what's happening to those communities, and you say, well, look, they need to figure out a way to protect themselves. Well, the one example they've got is Israel. And you know, right now we've got Iraqi Christians and other minorities in Iraq that are gathering together in the plain, you know, in the place called the Nineveh Plain in Iraq. They're basically saying, well, it looks like this is where we're going to make our last stand because we're subject to genocidal hostility by the Muslim majority in Iraq. And when you think about it, that's, you know, they're not looking for a sovereign state of their own, but they are looking for some sort of autonomy within Iraq. And so, and that looks a lot like what, you know, the Jews did in Israel. They all gathered in one place so that they could protect themselves.
Right.
So, and what we're looking at is that basically the ongoing depredation and, if you'll pardon the expression, the extirpation of religious and ethnic minorities, indigenous Christians that have been there for thousands of years, are slowly being, you know, strangled and wiped out. And, you know, the one community in the Middle East that's been able to kind of stand up against that type of treatment is Jews, Israeli Jews. And
you've had a lot of practice, many years of practice.
Yeah. And the one question, you know, that I think that these other communities are slowly starting to confront is whether or not they can actually, you know, transcend whatever historical anti-Semitism they might have had and choose the Jewish people as their example. And
right,
I think that we're starting to see some of them who will be willing to do that, and it's a very powerful transformation to see. And, you know, and the thing is that when you look at the, you know, the status of minorities in Israel, you know, at a certain point you have to say, why is it that these countries have attacked Israel? Or not, you know, or why are these peace activists and human rights activists attacked Israel with such a ferocity?
And
for the most part, remain silent about the mistreatment of these communities in the Middle East that really are subject to genocidal hostility.
So,
and I think that's changing, but it's been the story that's been told for the past decade or so, that, you know, Israel is an apartheid state intent on ethnic cleansing and mistreats its Christian population. And, you know, things aren't perfect between Christians and Jews in Israel, you know, but at the same time, it's, you know, their rights largely, they do have their advocates within Israeli society, and you know, they've got people who care about them. You know, Israeli Jews are worried about their safety. And
about the safety of Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, it's kind of like, you know, look, you're, you know, what type of moral calculus allows you to keep demonizing Israel while ignoring the mistreatment of Christians in the rest of the region? It's just disgusting. It's frankly disgusting.
And what is the motivation? Boker Tov, Dexter. This is Sonia.
I think a lot of it is, and I don't know if I said this the last time I was on your show, but look, there's 1.3 billion Muslims, and there's, what, maybe 13 or 14 million Jews on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you feel like criticizing somebody, who is it safer to criticize?
It's a bully mentality in many respects. It's bullying.
I think this is one of the things that, you know, is a member of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Jewish organization, and, you know, I'm a Roman Catholic, and I think your listeners know that. But the thing is that people complain all the time of being silenced by Jewish organizations and being censored. And it's like, look, all we did was just join the debate, and you're accusing us of censoring you, but... Then what about this woman by the name of Molly Norris that encouraged people to draw pictures of Muhammad in Seattle a few
mm-hmm.
months ago?
Mm-hmm.
There was an imam in Yemen that basically issued a fatwa against her and said that she should be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI visited her and said, look, you know, there's a fatwa against you, and she went underground.
Yeah.
She disappeared.
In America.
That happened in the United States. Right. And so, you know, you criticize, you know, Israel... You say terrible things about Jews, and you might get a letter from the ADL. You might get a letter from, a local Jewish federation. The Board of Rabbis might issue a statement, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you say something that offends Muslim religious sensibilities, you could very well, you know, be subject to a fatwa.
Mm-hmm.
And that fatwa is going to call for your death.
Right.
And yet, somehow, people talk about, you know, how... You know, Jewish groups censor their opposition. And I think it's incredible. I think it's incredible. You know, when the cartoon controversy, what was it, in Sweden and Norway took place, you know, a couple of years ago.
Denmark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, forgive me. You know, there was also, I think, criticism, you know, problems in other countries as well. And at a certain point, it just becomes a blur. But, you know, There were churches set on fire in the Middle East. And at a certain point, it's like, okay, what's going on here, and why is it that we continually, you know, why is it that the so-called, you know, progressive community keeps hammering away so relentlessly on Israel and doesn't stand up for, you know, the cartoonists? And I think it's a failure. I think people... You know, on one hand, maybe it's a failure of imagination, or maybe it's, you know, the success of imagination, because people can imagine what will happen if they actually do stand up to the mistreatment of Christians or attacks on free speech. You know, then they themselves become a target. It's not that hard to imagine that. And then at a certain point, they just say, well, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to make myself look like I'm, you know, really much more courageous than I am by attacking Israel. And, you know, and somebody might actually call me an anti-Semite. And, you know, and then I can go around and carry that accusation as a badge, but still get tenure, get my articles published, and still be able to go to conferences. But, you know, one of the things I just heard Waleed Farr is, and he's a Maronite Christian who lives now here in the United States. He's from Lebanon, and he's been writing about this issue for years. You know, he talks about how the academy, you know, in the United States loves to hear about how terrible Israel is, but they don't really want to see any criticism of Arab leaders or Muslim leaders. And, you know, the Middle East Studies Association is largely... been, you know, immune to any real debate over these issues. And as a result, and some of it has to do with the Saudi funding of, you know, scholars here in the United States.
Mm.
And, you know, and that's a reality. And so as a result, you know, we have a very, you know, distorted discourse about what's really going on. And, you know, I'm sorry, event. But,
yeah,
you know,
I think Sonia wanted to. Sonia wanted to ask us.
The Itamar killing just recently. You know, that family of five.
Oh yeah.
You know, they decapitated a 3-year-old,
a 3-month-old. Yeah.
And at a certain point, you know, I started to say, look, what about the churches? You know, and some churches have said something, but for the most part, you know, the mainline churches that they've been relatively silent. I haven't heard them say anything. And, and there is some, there is a very small, statements, and I don't find them credible of people saying maybe it was foreign workers, okay? And I've canvassed people that I trust and said, what are the chances of Thai foreign workers being responsible for that attack? And they laugh at me. They just say, so close to zero, it's zero.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that attack was an act of jihad.
Right.
And part of it is because of the decapitations. And so, at a certain point, and even if you have some doubt over who actually perpetrated the attack, there's no doubt that there was one terror group in the West Bank that claimed responsibility for it and then backed off. There's no doubt that people handed out candy in celebration of the attack. And there's no doubt that there's been ongoing incitement against Jews in Palestinian media for years.
But it's happened also. I'm sorry that I'm interrupting you. It's happened also in Britain. And I feel that once to be anti-Semitic, it wasn't the bon ton. Today, it is bon ton to say and to be anti-Semitic, very active anti-Semitic.
You see, that's one of the things that goes back to. There was some revulsion over the Holocaust. There was an understanding. There was a shock over it. People understood it. I think that's gone. I think at this point, what we have seen is the consensus that anti-Semitism is bad and totally unjustified and lethal to civil society has gone. And I think you're right, Sonia, and I'm worried about that because the problem is that if you tolerate anti-Semitism and it becomes a habit of mind that people can embrace, what happens is that then it makes it more difficult for people to really see what's going on. And this is one of the difficulties that I've had in trying to tell people about what's happening to Christians in the Middle East. When I tell Christians, here, and I think this is kind of changing, but past few years, when I talk about what has happened to Christians in the Middle East, the depredations that they have endured at the hands of Muslim extremists in the Middle East and, the Muslim majority and also the failure of governments to protect the rights of these Christians.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I cite researchers, such as Justice Reed Weiner or Bat Yor or Mordecai Nissan. Some of the people that have done the best research on this problem are Jews. And so when I talk about it, they say, well, who told you those facts? And at a certain, and I've actually had, conversations like this, and I say, well, and I name the researchers, and they say, who were they? And at a certain point, I say, I see what you're getting at. And I say, yeah, Zionist Jews.
Mm.
And so at a certain point, they say, oh, okay. And
it's not valid if it comes from that source.
It's not valid. We don't have to take it seriously. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important for Middle Eastern Christians here in the United States to speak up on behalf of their own interest and their own and tell their own story. And we are starting to see that now. But because people have been so used to, they find hostility towards Muslim in the Middle, towards Jews in the Middle East so unremarkable that they find hostility towards Jews so unremarkable in their own hearts that they can't really talk about Muslim hostility towards Jews in the region.
Dexter Van Zyl.
What happens, once that becomes a reality, then who are they to say anything about Muslim hostility towards Christians?
Dexter Van Zyl, we have to stop for a break. And when we come back, we would like to hear more about what's going on with the Christian communities in the Middle Eastern region, in Egypt, in Sudan, in in Iraq and, compared to how they're treated in Israel. We'll speak to you after the break. Dexter Van Zyl,
okay,
Christian media analyst from CAMRA, and this is WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, Israel is Real.
No fear, I'll not fear, no fear, lo ira o Adonai li, lo ira maya asele adam, Adonai li, lo ira maya asele adam, Adonai li, ve osure, va ani ye, ve vesone ye, Adonai li, ve osure,
this is WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, and this is Israel is Real. We'd like to remind you that you can keep donations coming and to keep our show on the air. You can write a check to Absolute Broadcasting and send it to our personal P.O. Box at P.O. Box 236, Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. You can find out more by visiting our website at israelisrealnh.com, israelisrealnh.com. And email us any feedback, anything you want to say, and find out how to become a sponsor to israelisrael1590@gmail.com, israelisrael1590@gmail.com. The patent and trademark law firm of Vern Main & Associates, a local firm with a global practice, is pleased to announce its new office location at 547 Amherst Street in Nashua and on the web at www.vernmain.com. For professional legal counseling on all intellectual property matters, contact the legal specialists at Vern Main & Associates at their offices on 547 Amherst Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, or on the web at www.vernmain.com. That's www.vernmaine.com.
Did you know that Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel? Did you know Israel, it's approximately about the size of New Jersey? To receive Vision's emails alert and be informed about Vision educational activities and opportunities, please visit Vision's website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org.
Dr. James Haas of Vanguard Dental Group in Derry, New Hampshire, is a board-certified pediatric dentist who specializes in treating children with special emotional and physical needs. He treats with sedation dentistry and operating room dentistry. He's extremely talented at putting anxious children at ease so they have a positive dental experience. Dr. Jim is currently accepting new patients and would love to help your child enjoy visiting the dentist. So if you would like to contact Dr. Jim Haas, that's 603-434-1586, or you can visit www.vanguarddentalgroup.com. That's one whole long word, vanguarddentalgroup.com, to learn more about Dr. Haas.
Rachel is spreading beautiful music across the globe. To hear Rachel's unique sound and to book Rachel to perform for you live, just go to www.rachelmusic.net, which is www.rahelmusic.net.
I will feel no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
And we're back on WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. This is Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel. We're speaking today with Dexter Van Zyl. He's the Christian media analyst from CAMRA. And Dexter, shalom.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. We wanted to hear about more in detail about what's going on with the Christian communities in the Middle Eastern region.
Well, right now I've been paying most attention to what's happening to Christians in Iraq and Egypt right now, because they have been the most vocal right now. In Halloween of last year, there was an attack on a church in Baghdad that killed almost 70 people. And essentially, I think this drew attention, a lot of attention, to the ongoing mistreatment of Christians in Iraq. And when the United States invaded, ousted Saddam Hussein from power in about 2003, I think, there was about 1.5 million Iraqi Christians. And right now, there is probably less than 500,000.
Wow.
I've seen, you know, different numbers. A lot of them have just, they've left. Some of them have come to the United States. Large numbers of them are living now in Syria and Jordan and other neighboring countries. And they are, frankly, you know, if you go to our blog at blog.camera.org, there is an archbishop from Iraq that has basically said, look, we're living in near genocide conditions. And essentially, you know, I think this is really one of the troubling things that we're contending with. This is that, you know, while we have tens of thousands of American troops in Iraq that you would think would be somehow capable of or responsible for providing for the safety of those Christians.
I thought that's what they were doing there.
That's, well, you know, ultimately what we see is that this is the one country where they're being driven out. And then, and so what we're looking at, you know, now I've seen different estimates, you know, one in a little more than, you know, one has said, you know, about 1.4 million to 500,000. So we're looking, and the Archbishop called that figure, according to the Catholic News Service, highly optimistic. And one of the things that he said, and this is a quote, is the past is terrifying, the present is not promising, so everything is telling us there is no future for Christians. And
that's a grim outlook.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, at this point there are people that are starting to draw attention to the mistreatment of these Christians and to the, you know, their ethnic cleansing. But the reason why we haven't really heard very much about it is that American policymakers have basically viewed Iraq through the lens of three groups, through the Kurdish group, the Shias, and the Sunnis. And what happened was is that the Christians were largely ignored. And so their interests and their concerns were not taken into consideration. There was some money that was supposed to be diverted to protect or help us, you know, maintain their well-being in Iraq, but for the most part, that money hasn't really gotten to them. They've dug a couple of wells, but nothing serious. And so ultimately, I think, you know, unless something really happens soon and people really start to scream and shout, I think we're looking at the depredation and potentially the extirpation of Christians from Iraq. And, you know, we just had a conference in Chicago where we heard testimony from Juliana Tamarazi, who is the director of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council, which is a group you can find on the Internet. And I, you know, one of the questions I asked her is what happens if the American troops leave? And she said, well, there's a lot of Christians that say, look, we are Iraqis, and this is, and most Iraqis are very ambivalent, or they want the troops to leave, or, you know, they say, look, we're Iraqis and this is our country, and, you know, the Iraqis need to govern their own country and we'll brace ourselves. But then there's another school of thought that is, you know, that things aren't going to go very well. And then there was another commentator at the conference, Edward Odishu, who basically said, look, right now they're attacking the very roots of Mesopotamian civilization in the Middle East. And, you know, by driving the Christians out, they're attacking the very roots of Iraqi civilization. And, you know, and this was a guy, who, you know, who's clearly, you know, very knowledgeable about what's going on, and so I'm worried. And then I think in Egypt, you know, they're about 10% of the population. There are different estimates, and Egypt's got a population of about 80 million. And so I hear different, you know, you know, 8 to 10 million, 8 to 12 million, and sometimes I hear estimates as high as 12 to 15 million. And so the numbers, I don't know, aren't very good, but 10% seems about legit. And they have been suffering from mistreatment under Muslim rule for, you know,
centuries.
Hundreds of years,
yeah.
You know, since about the 7th century. And we, and you know, at one point they were the majority, but slowly but surely they were, you know, some of them were forced to convert, some of them fled, you know, some were probably killed. And right now in the modern era, what we're looking at, clearly some of them were killed during the invasion, of course, but, you know, and I, what has happened is that basically right now, you know, since the revolution or the uprising that began on January 25th, there have been, you know, ongoing attacks on the Coptic Christian community. And you know, the, I guess what it's fair to say is that there have been ongoing attacks on the Coptic Christian community before, during, and after the uprising. And and so, and the problem is that, you know, just as we had huge numbers of American troops in Iraq, we send huge amounts of money to Egypt, right. Mostly to their military, and the military has done a very bad job of protecting the safety of this Christian minority.
Well, in most so places I think that we support here from America, I think you could probably say the same.
Well, you see, I think, you know, I, and I haven't really thought much about it. What other countries are you thinking about?
Well, you know, we are supporting Libya. We support,
yeah.
You know, there's other places all around the Middle East that we send money to.
Right.
And
well, you know, I just saw something, you know, just on an offhand way, you know, it was funny when we finally prevailed upon Libya to pay that huge multi-billion dollar compensation package for the Lockerbie bombing. There are reports that, you know, as soon as that deal went down, that he basically brought in the executives from all of the major oil companies and said, okay, fork it over. And so, I mean, you know, he's pretty brazen. And so, and the, and as far as the, you know, the rights of minorities, you know, there's a very small, I think, subterranean church in Libya that I don't know very little about. So I can't really speak, you know, with any information on that. But, you know, the thing is that you would think that at least in Iraq and in Egypt that the Christians would be, you know, relatively safe, okay? But that's not the case, okay? You know, on New Year's Day of this year, there was a bombing of a church in Alexandria that killed 23 people.
Mm-hmm.
And this bombing, you know, I predicted this attack along with another another Christian, a Coptic Christian from Egypt, who lives here in the United States. He had been pointing to me, you know, some videos and some statements on the internet that he could translate because he's fluent in Arabic, and he said, there's going to be an attack, and it's going to be soon. And when I looked at some of the things, too, I said, yeah, you're right. And so we both agreed that there was going to be an attack. And so, but, you know, the incitement was clearly obvious because we knew that there was going to be an attack over the Christmas season because we just kind of guessed that that the celebration of Christmas was going to be, you know, an opportunity for extremists or somebody in Egypt to basically, you know, use this to strike fear in the Christian community there. And what happened was is that after that attack, there was a fair number of protests by the Coptic Christian community saying, look, we need better protection from, you know, the Mubarak regime. And this was when Mubarak was still in power.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who think that those were basically, you know, the prototypes for the uprising that started on January 25th when they saw Christians actually go out in the streets and protest and say, look, we need better protection. We need justice. That was what planted, you know, the courage in everyone else's hearts to riot, or you know, not to riot, but to uprise a few days later, or you know, a couple of weeks later. And clearly, the Coptic Christian community played a very, you know, vocal and visible role in the January 25th uprising. But even as that uprising was taking place, some of them were being attacked in Upper Egypt. A family, two families, a total of 11 Coptic Christians were murdered. and their goods were stolen, largely because the police were no longer around to provide any order. And at one point during the uprising, there were monasteries in Upper Egypt that told the army, look, you know, we need protection. Because one of the things that, I don't know if your listeners have knew this, but during the uprising, a large number of prisoners escaped from the Egyptian prison.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they created pandemonium.
Yes.
And the monastery said, look, we need protection. And they said, well, look to yourselves. So they built, you know, fences or walls, brick walls around their monasteries. And a couple of weeks later, sometime later, the Egyptian military itself came along and knocked them down with armored personnel carriers.
Yes.
And so, you know, so, and these were the very, this was the very same institution that told them to look, to take care of yourselves. And so, you know, and the thing is that I don't want to emphasize everything that's happened since the uprising, but there was a church that was blown up in the province of Helwan. And the day after the church was blown up, Muslims prayed on the site. And at that point, initially the Egyptian military had promised to build, rebuild the church in time for Easter. But then when they saw that the Muslims were praying on the site, they backed off from that promise because under Islamic law, once Muslims pray on a worship site, it can no longer go back to being a Christian church. And that was the whole reason why they prayed there. They were staking out their claim. And at that point, the Egyptian military said, well, we got a problem. And they backed off on their promise. And again, the Egyptian cops, the Coptic community protested. And eventually, the Egyptian military relented. But, you know, this has been an ongoing problem. And if people, you know, want to learn more, there's a document that was published by Christian Solidarity International and also the Coptic Foundation for Human Rights. It was published in November 2009, and it's titled The Disappearance, Forced Conversions, and Forced Marriages of Coptic Christian Women in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm still looking at this document, but it looks like there is a problem of Coptic women basically being kidnapped, raped, forced to marry their oppressors, and then converted out of the Coptic, or, you know, or the Christian faith. And this was, you know, has been a long been a problem, and it's not something that we've heard an awful lot about. But at a certain point, you know, it becomes clear that the Egyptian people have a decision to make over what type of society they're going to have.
I think the entire Muslim culture needs to rethink about how they are behaving and what their goals are. But
yeah,
Dexter, we've got about 5 minutes.
Okay.
I would like to sort of, you know, maybe we can, is there any possibility we can have a little bit of hope here and
I
maybe
think so. Yeah,
look
absolutely.
At the positive,
and I think
you know.
The real, you raise the issue is that, you know, the real question at this point, and it's at the root of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and it's at the root of the mistreatment of Christians throughout the Middle East, is how is it that Muslims are going to deal with non-Muslims? And this is a very crucial issue. And this is not, you know, a unique issue just to Islam. It was a problem that Christianity has had to deal with, and particularly in reference to the Jewish people. And clearly, I mean, let's be clear, you know, Christianity, you know, perpetrated, or and I think that's too heavy a statement, but let's put it this way, baptized Christians in Europe ended up perpetrating a terrible genocide of Jews largely because of their beliefs about the Jewish people that had been inculcated with as a result of their religious faith. And, you know, historically, Islam has basically stated that Christians and Jews should be subject people, and that infidels are, in some instances, to be killed or forcibly converted. And, you know, this is the 21st century, and there are, you know, large numbers of Muslims that have said, we can no longer treat non-Muslims the way we have been. And we have to improve our treatment of women. We have to improve the status of women. We need to enter the modern world. And there are some writers out there that are saying, and we also need to abandon, you know, the anti-Semitism that has sadly been you know, an important aspect of our religious faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a troublesome thing to have to point to. But I think there is hope, and I think that we need to work very hard to pay attention to the people who are actually working on behalf of these things.
Yeah, I think that there is a hope that if Christians and Jews can come together, that the same can happen, you know, with the Muslim world. We can pray for that.
Right. Because Muslims, you know, they believe that, you know, they have disagreements over which son was to be sacrificed by Abraham. But they do have one very important tenet of their faith, which was that God stayed Abraham's hand. Okay? And that, I think, is hopefully the foundation of some sort of rapprochement going forward. That's an important thing that we have to remember. And the one challenge that I think moderate Muslims can level at their fellow Muslims is that if we really truly believe that God is merciful and just, then how does he really want us to treat the indigenous populations in the Middle East? And
Dexter,
that's the challenge.
Dexter Van Zyl from CAMRA, Christian Media Analyst, we are so glad to have you again. We wish we had another hour to speak with you and to hear what you've got to say, because what you've got to say is so important. We would like to tell our listeners how to contact you and how to hear more. How can they find you?
They can find us on the internet at CAMRA, CAMERA.org. CAMRA.org.
And you mentioned a blog. Was that blog.camera.org?
Yeah, blog.camera.org. And you can also just click on it from our main website.
So that's Dexter Van Zyl of CAMRA. That's www.camera.org, CAMERA.org, CAMRA.org. Dexter Van Zyl, thank you so much for being here again with us today.
Thank you.
We'll have you again, of course, in the future. And we hope that we'll have more positive news the next time.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, thank you.
Well, it is all about changing education. That's it.
Yep.
Parashat Shmini, about education.
Right, our Torah portion of the week, which people are welcome to sponsor.
The road to holiness does not start with lofty ideals or sublime thoughts. The road to holiness starts with few small boring steps, like being a decent moral person and controlling, like, our emotions or our appetites. A Jew who tries to seek holiness sitting on top of some mountain in the Far East will find it impossible to achieve this goal. The view may be inspiring, but he will find no growth or nourishment reaching this core. If we sanctify ourselves down here in this lowly world, with all its barriers to holiness, if we guard our mouth, our eyes, and our ears, then the Torah promises us that we will be given help to lift us to lofty peaks of holiness. It all starts with one small step. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. We're Rachel and
Sonia.
This is Israel is Real. Our theme song, Hine Matov, is by myself, Rachel. You can find me on the internet at rachelmusic.net, RAHELmusic.net. We're on the air every Friday morning, 10 to 11 in the morning, and on the radio, WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. You can find us on the internet also at www.israelisraelnh.com. That's israelisraelnh.com. We'd like to thank our guest today, Dexter Van Zyl of CAMRA, and you can find him at camera.org. That's www.camera.org, camera.org. We'll listen to some wonderful music. Going out, this is Israel is Real.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
When we've been there 10,000 years.
light shining as the sun. We've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first
come down and join more than 70,000 people at the annual Manchester St. Pancras